In a new book, the food writer Mark Schatzker explores our relationship with food. And relationship seems like the right comparison because sometimes you're in sync with someone, sometimes you're just not. And Schatzker says we Americans have a dysfunctional relationship with our food, which is manifest in our health, in the alarmingly high percentage of people who are obese or who have diabetes or heart disease. Basically, we don't know when to stop eating because our bodies are designed to know when to stop, but there's something that's overriding that mechanism. And Schatzker thinks he knows what it is. It's not fat. It's not carbs. It's in some ways about the way we experience food. Schatzker explained it to us with a story. It's about the difference between wanting something and liking something.
I spent several days in Leipzig, Germany, with a German researcher where she deals with some of Germany's most challenging cases of disordered eating. Many of her patients have binge eating disorder. And she let me experience some of the therapy she's developed. It's called hedonic therapy, which literally means pleasure therapy. And it really opened my eyes as to the powerful hold food has on us and the different ways we experience it. She gave me two potato chips. She had me open a bag, cheese and onion flavor. She said, listen to the pop that the bag makes. Inhale this rush of aroma. Stick your hand in the bag and just extract two potato chips. Hold one in each hand. And I wasn't allowed to eat them. I could nibble them. I could sniff them. She even said at one point, rub them together. That struck me as silly. Why would you rub two potato chips together? But the effect it had on me was astounding. I was overcome with this absolute intense craving to eat these potato chips. And it made me realize chips have a kind of a hold on me, something that goes beyond my ability to resist, almost a controlling influence. Then she did something very different. She produced a small square of dark chocolate. She dimmed the lights. She handed it to me and she said, just place this gently on your tongue. Let the heat of your body melt it. Close your eyes if you like. I did. And the chocolate sat there at first and did nothing. But then slowly it began to melt. And as it did, it took me along on a journey. I was its passenger. It was my leader, my guide, and I sat there as I went on this trip with it. It was such a profoundly different experience, and it made me realize that what we think of as deliciousness or pleasure really is two different things.
One thing is wanting. That's the chips. The other is liking.
These are two different neural circuits. We have different words to describe them, wanting. We have many words in English to describe that. Desire is probably the best one, but it's a visceral kind of desire. It's not wanting world peace. It's wanting a glass of water after a run on a hot summer day. Wanting is craving. It's mediated by the neurotransmitter many people have heard of called dopamine. People used to think dopamine was pleasure, but we now know that it's motivation. And at its most intense, it has a profound and lasting grip on us. And it's very different from what the psychologists called liking. And that is mediated by opioid transmitters. And that is the pleasure impact moment. That's when you put the food in your mouth and you light up with joy because of the wonderful taste.
And what you're saying with the book is that liking is the way forward if we're going to cure our problems with food and obesity.
Yes. For so long, we have regarded indulging in food as a dangerous thing to do, as something that, you know, something that evolution gave us that takes us to a bad place, when in fact, this is not the cause, but the cure of what bedevils us when it comes to food and eating.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So the cure is to eat delicious food? Well, kind of. But you have to understand the ways our bodies work when it comes to food, because Schatzker says our impulses, hunger, feeling satiated, they're all finely tuned systems. And pleasure, the actual quality of food, does matter to the machine. Schatzker's book is called The End of Craving.
It all started a long time ago. I think it was 1997. I went to visit my brother who was living in Chile at the time. And it started with a steak. We went up to the beach and, you know, Chileans don't like people from Argentina. And it is a testament to how good the beef was at that time in Argentina that they will say the best beef comes from Argentina. So he bought a whole tenderloin and we grilled it over coals. And it was a life-changing steak. It was just so profoundly good. But I asked what I thought was a simple question, which was, why did this steak taste so good? But that led to, you know, more interesting questions like, why do we like meat? Why do we like what we like? How does flavor work? But all through this, there was this tension I felt that so much of sort of, you know, orthodox nutrition lived in a kind of fear of food. We were always being told to be fearful of various nutrients. It was fat in the 1980s, and then it was carbs. And there was always this idea that there's something dangerous about food. And I thought there was a tension because there were so many things that just seemed to obviously be wrong with that, like the fact that you might visit a country like Japan, which has incredibly low rates of obesity, and the food is just incomparably delicious. Or the fact that in the middle of summer, I would eat a ripe peach and it would just be so incredibly good. And you'd think, well, here's something that's amazingly delicious and it's not bad for me. And I just became very interested in our relationship between what we think of as delicious and what is good for us and how it all really works. Because it just never made sense to me that somehow evolution could have programmed us to kind of eat ourselves to death. That just seemed wrong on some level. And that's sort of what sent me down this path.
So explain how it is we see our food problem right now. Because in the book you say, it's kind of like you walk into a room and two people are arguing about the cause for the common cold.
Yeah, so if you could think of people arguing about the cause of the cold and one person says it's the sniffles and the other person says, no, it's clearly coughing, and they yell at each other and they're both sure that the other's wrong and they're right. And that's how our food problem has been. You know, every year or two, there seems to be a new diet. I can think of all the ones growing up. There was the Scarsdale diet, the Pritikin diet. I remember the Zone, then Atkins became big, and then that morphed into paleo, keto. What's so peculiar is this enduring enthusiasm we have that, oh, the new perfect diet has finally arrived. And it's never really occurred to us that maybe this isn't working. Fat was the enemy when I was growing up. And then more recently, it's for about 20 years now, it's been carbs. Right. We also talk about eating too much and going on a diet. We say when you eat too much food, that makes you fat. And in a very literal sense, that is true. That is the proximal cause. But there's something deeper that's pushing us to eat more. And that is this kind of invisible force that we all live with, we all struggle with, but we haven't identified. We think it's eating too much, but if it were simply that, we would stop eating too much. And we clearly cannot stop. We've been fighting this battle since the 1980s. And the harder we fight, the worse it gets.
Yeah. So part of what you do in the book is you break down this myth that we have come to believe about our bodies and its reaction to food. And I want to ask you about that. Because the myth is that we humans are basically idiots when it comes to eating. Dimwitted is the term you actually use. But we think of ourselves as these kind of helpless slaves. So talk a little bit about the myth that's there. And what's the truth? Because you say we're a more intelligent eater than we give ourselves credit for.
Far more. And we see this. This is cultural in the sense that there's famous sayings like if it tastes good, spit it out, which is emphatically stating, you know, if something tastes good, it's bad for you. But we also see this in science. There's the thrifty gene theory, the thrifty gene hypothesis, which states that, you know, famine was an ever-present danger as we evolved. So our forebears who might have had an inclination to carry a bit of extra weight would have been more likely to reproduce. So it was baked into our genes. I don't think either of these takes is correct. Let's focus for a second on the scientific part. There's lots and lots of reasons why it would not make sense to carry extra weight as we were evolving. If you need a lot more energy just to power that body, the same way you need more gasoline to drive a bigger car. So that's, you know, more inefficient, and you're consuming more food than you otherwise would need to. But it also means you're slower to accelerate. You're slower to stop. You might injure yourself as you're trying to turn quickly. If something's chasing you to eat you, it's got a better chance of getting you, and it's got a more sumptuous meal once it does catch you. And if you're trying to catch prey, that prey is going to have a better chance at outrunning you. But there's another even deeper way to look at it, and that's this whole idea of our relationship to calories. As we evolved, the ratio between the size of our brain and our bodies changed. So when we were more like our chimpanzee cousins, we had a much smaller brain and a much larger digestive tract. Brains are big energy hogs. They just really use a lot of energy. So a smaller brain didn't need as much energy, and we had a long digestive tract. We would digest kind of fibrous plant matter. Well, as we evolved, as we know, this brain got really big. That big energy hog needed different food. So our digestive tract got faster and smaller, and we upgraded to more calorie-dense food. We started eating nuts. We started eating fatty meat when we could get it. We started eating ripe fruit. So people have used this as a kind of case to say, you know, we're sort of born addicted to calories because that's what made us human. But if you really, you know, focus on the microscope, that doesn't make sense, because what made us human, what this calorie-dense diet gave us, was the luxury of time. So if you go back and look at those chimpanzees, they spent about 80, 85% of their day just getting food and eating food. When we developed this calorie-dense diet, that meant we could stop eating and do other things like build structures, build weapons, tan skins, you know, tell stories, create myths, do all the things that make us human and separate us from animals. And there's something very important there. We had to have the ability to say, I've had enough. I'm going to stop eating and do something else. It's the chimpanzees and the cows that are really more like, you know, addicts who can't tear away themselves from food. They're constantly eating. To be human means you have to have this ability to say, I've had enough. I'm going to go do something else. So this problem that we have with, you know, eating too much and sort of being captured in some way by food is a very recent phenomenon, and I don't think it's baked into our genes.
Yeah. One of the key stories that you tell in the book to really explain all of this is the story about this malady that people start observing, and maybe it's the 18th century. Goethe is the first to write about it and really understand it. Take us through this story, if you would, because it's really important. It's an important part of the book and really helps us understand how this is starting to work.
Yeah, so Johann von Goethe is he's like Germany's Shakespeare. He's a poet. He's a cultural, you know, icon. He's a keystone of German literary culture. And he went through a funny life experience where he just sort of took off from life for 2 years. He abandoned his friends. He went under a pseudonym and lived in Italy for 2 years. And he wrote this incredibly detailed diary. And on the way, as he descended from the Alps into what is, you know, we now call Northern Italy, the language changed. And he noticed that the women sort of had this hideous skin color. And he thought they looked sick and they looked terrible. And the locals had a term for it. They called it pellagra, which meant literally rough skin. And that's how it started. It would start with skin scales. It usually started with a farmer. It would begin in the spring, and there might be one or two scales. It would go away. And then the next year would come back worse, and it would develop. They would get terrible diarrhea. They would lose their appetite. They would become delirious. Sometimes they would behave strangely. They might attack children. And eventually it resulted in death. And it became an epidemic. It spread. It was this terrible disease, and nobody had any idea what caused it. They had all sorts of bizarre theories. Yeah. Well, then pellagra somehow showed up about a little over 100 years ago in Georgia. It somehow crossed the Atlantic and appeared in the United States. And here, too, it was an epidemic. It spread to neighboring states. It was all over the South. It became known as the pellagra belt. And again, no one had any idea what caused it. And much like our obesity epidemic, no one knew the cause. And yet there was this rotating cast of experts that were all sure they had the answer, and they would get into public spats about it. Now, we eventually discovered the cause, and that discovery was a key moment in our understanding of micronutrition. It was Joseph Goldberger, an epidemiologist. We all know what epidemiologists are now because of COVID. And he went to he was dealing with patients, and he said, leave this, you know, leave all the dirty bed sheets and all the filth. Just leave that. I don't want to change anything. People thought he was nuts. And he started playing around with their diet. And he found that he could cure pellagra by feeding them food like beans or meat or cheese or milk. And that led to a breakthrough moment in our understanding of food, which is to say it contains essential elements. We now call them vitamins and minerals. And the vitamin that was lacking for victims of pellagra is what we now call niacin, or B3. So for hundreds of years, this essential element had been causing terrible sickness on both sides of the Atlantic, in northern Italy and in the southern U.S.
And the idea that it was caused by this nutritional deficiency, you described this as this world-changing revelation. And then what you get at in the book, and this is important, is there are two approaches to dealing with this. There's an American approach and there's an Italian approach. Let's start with what the Americans did, because it's interesting to talk about this and then we'll contrast it with what the Italians came up with.
The Americans did what I think we would think was the sensible thing to do. Yeah. They looked at the fact that people are missing this important vitamin from the diet. Vitamins contain the word vital. They are necessary for good health. And they said, let's give people vitamins. They passed laws in the early 1940s that encouraged, but essentially made law, the enrichment of flour with B vitamins, niacin, but also riboflavin and thiamine, and also the mineral iron. And it worked superbly well. Almost overnight, pellagra just like poof, disappeared. It was such an amazing union of cutting-edge science with public policy, and it eradicated a terrible disease. It worked beautifully.
So what happens to our bodies with this infusion? Let me put it this way, this artificial, I guess, infusion of niacin and thiamine. What do our bodies do with that? And just explain, for the average listener, what are we eating on a day-to-day basis that has that fortification, that enrichment?
Well, B vitamins are really important for energy metabolism. And what's so interesting about that Southern diet, you know, on some level, these people were starving, but they were eating pork fat, molasses, and grits, which is to say corn flour. That's an incredibly calorically dense diet. So you think, how can you starve on that? Like, there's so much calories in that. And the reason is that you cannot metabolize calories without B vitamins, niacin being very important for that. So we did something interesting is we put niacin in, processed carbs, which is sort of a context that had never appeared before. Right. And it worked really well. But what's so interesting to think about is that's not at all the approach they took in Italy. And I think this is the root of where we see so much of the difference in the two cultures and how they approach food.
Yeah. So to be clear, what you're saying is that this is not an all-encompassing theory that claims to explain every case of obesity, this fortification thing. But you do say this is the change. It seems like it is a crucial moment.
This was a huge moment for two reasons. The first is that it led us on the path to start putting vitamins in things, and it didn't end with enrichment. That was just the beginning. We also have voluntary fortification. So companies are allowed to put vitamins, and they use a lot of B vitamins in all sorts of things. They're in breakfast cereals, they're in donuts, they're in energy drinks. Companies love to put them in because every time we see the word vitamin, we think, well, it must be good for you. It's got vitamins in it.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, that caused us to just start dumping a lot of B vitamins in our food supply. But it was also, there's kind of a metaphorical thing where we looked at food and we said, food on its own is incomplete and we need to step in and fix what's wrong with food because, you know, with our inept appetites, we don't know what to eat. There's something wrong with food. So we must step in and fix things. And it's an interesting approach to take. It certainly worked well to get rid of pellagra. But what we haven't asked is, could there have been an unforeseen consequence to this?
Mm. So the other part of the story, of course, is that contrast between what the Americans did, how they responded to the pellagra crisis, and what the Italians did. And as you explain it in the book, the Italians stayed on the old road. They stuck with a path they knew. Take us through this.
It's amazing when you look at what Italy did, knowing that we knew what this nutrient was and how you could, you know, manufacture it and put it in food, you'd think, why wouldn't they do this? But what they did seems almost incomprehensible, like the king had put his dim-witted, you know, nephew in charge of food policy.
Right.
They said, poor people should raise rabbits because, you know, rabbits are cheap to raise. They thought there should be communal bread ovens. People even encouraged poor people to drink wine, which it's almost like funny. It's like, wow, people have a nutritional deficiency and you're saying vino. Mm. But there was a kind of, I don't know if wisdom is the word, maybe they were accidentally correct. The wines back then weren't very well filtered, so they would have had a lot of yeast in them. And yeast has a lot of niacin, so the wine actually was actually good advice. The interesting thing about Italy is that their sort of old school approach worked. They literally ate their way out of a nutritional deficiency. It took longer, but it also worked.
Mark Schatzker, he's a writer in residence at the Modern Diet and Physiology Research Center at Yale University. His new book is The End of Craving: Recovering the Lost Wisdom of Eating Well. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listener support makes programming possible on KUER. You can easily manage your donation anytime with MyKUER. It's a place to go to update your contact information, find tax receipts, change the amount of your donation, or switch payment methods. For example, you can update that expired credit card with a direct donation from your bank account. Sign into your personal online donor profile at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the food writer Mark Schatzker is talking about how we restore a healthy relationship with our food. In his new book, he explains how by refining and processing food over the years, we've been short-circuiting this finely tuned system in our body that tells us when to stop eating. Good food is supposed to give pleasure, but there's a difference between wanting and liking something. The book is called The End of Craving. Italy is full of delicious food, food with carbs, food with fat, food with sugar. But you say Italians, just in general, they're not afflicted with the same level of obesity, not in the same way as the rest of the Western world. Explain why that is, because you go through some of the theories there, you know, whether they just have more self-discipline, they walk more, they eat a traditional diet. You say that's not really it.
No, and what's so interesting is that they were so much like us, that is to say the southern U.S. and northern Italy had the exact same problem. But a century later, they couldn't be more different. The southern U.S. went from being the pellagra belt to being the diabetes belt or the obesity belt. If you go to northern Italy, it's like a trip to Alice in Wonderland. It seems to defy everything we've ever thought about, you know, is wrong with food. They revere food. They get in arguments over food. In Bologna is where we get the word bologna or bologna from. There they call it mortadella, and it looks a little bit like bologna, only you can see these cubes of white fat, just cubes of fat in it. They are not afraid of fat. We spent 20 years, you know, screaming to the hills about fat. It's the killer. They're also not afraid of carbs. They revere pasta. And if this indulgence in delicious food were really the cause of all our ills, well, you'd think northern Italy, which does not eat a Mediterranean diet, where the food is so good, you know, hordes of visitors arrive by the plane load just to eat what the locals are eating, well, you'd think they would be the plumpest in the world. And they are among the very thinnest. The rate of obesity in the United States is now 42%. In northern Italy, it's less than 8%. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah. Mind-boggling when you think about the risotto that they love and the polenta that they love and all of that food that they love. I don't want to give it away because we'll get to it in a moment, but what's the difference? So put a pin in that, everyone. Let's talk about, as you do in the book, you say maybe the truth about eating and body weight is not what we think because we really don't understand how we think. Let's talk about that. Explain what you mean, how we think.
Well, you know, we think that we can go on diets. We think, I'm going to cut this out. I'm going to count calories. I just need to, you know, look at the back of this package to see how many calories in it, and I'm going to make a decision like that. We think we have executive function over how much we eat, and that's absolutely not true. The brain controls our body weight. It controls our body weight the same way it controls our body temperature, the same way it controls your heart rate. This is something science has known for decades, and yet it absolutely burst the balloon of dieting, this idea that we can just sort of make some little change in our day-to-day routine and it's going to have a radical effect on our life. There's a different part of our brain that thinks about eating. That's where our urges and our desires and our satiety comes from. And we can't mentally, you know, access it and start to change it. We have to understand how that part of the brain thinks if we ever want to have a chance at changing our relationship with food.
So this gets us to the story of a physiologist named Michel Cabanac. And in the book, you tell the story. He has this moment of, I guess you could call it kind of an epiphany in 1963, where he discovers this inner system in the human body. Take us through this part.
Well, he was doing work on body temperature. And back then, the idea of whether water felt hot or cold, back then, the textbooks would tell you it all came down to the relationship of the water temperature to your skin. So if water was, you know, significantly hotter than skin temperature, it felt hot and unpleasant. And if it was significantly colder, it felt cold. Well, he had just done an experiment on himself where he'd immersed himself in some hot water for a significant period of time and was taking various measurements. He was very early in his career. He didn't have an assistant yet. And he had to scrub out the tub because there was a new subject coming along very soon. So he's all like hot and sweaty and he's scrubbing it down with bleach. And then it's time to rinse the tub. So he turns on the cold water tap and it sort of splashes over his hand. And it just feels bracing and wonderful. And he just sort of basks in that moment. And then he goes, hold on a second. According to the textbooks, this isn't supposed to feel good. This is really cold water. So he immediately gets this, this subject shows up and he sticks this guy in really hot water. And then he says, he measures his internal core temperature rises and he says, stick your hand in this bucket of ice water. And the guy sticks his hand and he says, how does it feel? He says, oh, feels wonderful. Merveilleux, something like that in French he would have said. Again, this isn't what the textbooks say. So then Michel Cabanac dumps buckets of ice into this bathtub and it goes from being hot to cold. And then soon this guy is shivering. He's freezing. Now he sticks his hand in a bucket of hot water. How does it feel? It feels incredible. So the water that before would have felt horrible, you know, when you're hot, hot water feels terrible. When you're cold, it feels wonderful. And what he realized was that what felt hot or cold was not based on skin temperature. It was based on the internal milieu, that there was this internal temperature. But even more interesting, what we desired, what our urges told us to do was in harmony with what our body needed. Yeah. If we are overheating, our urges say, get cold. We need coldness. If we're cold, the urge says, you need to be warm. And pleasure, in this sense, you know, we think as Westerners that pleasure is something to be repressed. And there's this epiphany that pleasure is actually in service to our bodily needs. And this, of course, makes sense, right? We evolved with this sense of pleasure. What's it there for? It's there to help us survive.
Right, right. I want to underscore that because you say, so basically what's happening here is our body, what felt good was healthy. The two are connected.
Yes, exactly. What felt good in the moment was what was of optimal value to your physiological well-being.
Yeah. So Cabanac starts thinking about, he's thinking about body temperature, and then he shifts to eating, you say. If the body is good at regulating temperature, is it good about regulating body weight? So talk about the experiments that he comes up with here, because one of the things that he wants to figure out is why is it people were eating more than they needed to? So talk about the experiments here. This is a really interesting part as well.
Well, it was a really interesting observation on his point because he looked at people with obesity and said, it doesn't make sense. It's like seeing somebody walking around wearing a sweater on a hot day. Why would the body do this? He himself had always, you know, he just sort of ate what he wanted. He loved French food and he was fine. He'd always been sort of weighed like 150 pounds. So he started to do some experiments. One, he got his boss actually, and he said, don't eat anything for, you know, go to bed, don't eat anything in the morning, come to my office. And he started feeding him toffees. And, you know, how's the first toffee? Delicious. How's the second toffee? Delicious. He gives him toffee after toffee. And eventually the toffees are awful. I mean, they started being wonderful. And in the course of the morning, they go to being awful. And which is to say, some internal change had happened. The toffees didn't change at all. They were still exact same factory produced toffee. So then he thought, okay, somebody might say, well, it's just sort of the taste of toffee that gets to be annoying. So he would do an experiment where he would fast somebody and he'd give them a sniff of orange syrup and let them taste some sugar water. How does the sugar water taste? Delicious. How does the orange syrup smell? It smells wonderful. Then he has them drink about 200 milliliters of sugar water. So they're swallowing a whole bunch of calories. And then a short while later, he repeats the experiment. All of a sudden, it changes. That orange syrup isn't appealing at all. And no, the last thing I want is a taste of sugar water, which is just to say that when we consume calories, this changes the internal milieu. And our urges change in response. When we're hungry and we need energy, sugar water and orange syrup is beguiling. It's delicious. I want that. But then when we're sated, it just changes course. And we say, I don't want that. So there's evidence that food is like temperature, and our relationship to calories is based on our need. He then did an even more interesting experiment where he starved himself, he and three colleagues. They tried to lose an excessive amount of weight. They found it was easy at first. Then it became very difficult. And he was absolutely plagued by food cravings. He dreamt of gorging on food and would wake up and think, oh my God, I've ruined the experiment, only to realize, no, it was just a dream. He began to take off his watch at weigh-ins, to anything just to lose an extra few grams here and there. He would inch his feet over to the edge of the scale. He finally reached this weight that he was trying to get down to. They'd done it. But now he was a very different person because he did the orange and sugar water test again on an empty stomach. It was beguiling, but then he drank some, but it was still beguiling, as though his body was saying, no, I know you had some, but I need more. Yeah. And then they celebrated the end of their experiment by going to this fabulous French bistro and absolutely gorging, just eating an unbelievable amount of food in this one session. And then over the weeks that followed, he just sort of ate as he pleased, and he bounced back to his body weight, 150 pounds. That's what he'd always weighed. And he just bounced back like a crumpled marshmallow springing back to form. And then he just stopped eating. He stopped gaining. He came back to his weight, and there he was. And it was as though the brain has a set point. The brain says, I know how much I want you to weigh, just like I know how much I want your temperature to be, and I know how fast I want your heart to beat. The brain has a brilliance for eating that we barely comprehend.
Okay, so let's talk about another element that you explore in the book. This is how you explain it in the book. You say, for hundreds of millions of years, the food, humans, and the creatures that came before us didn't tell lies. Fat tasted like fat. Sugar tasted sweet. There wasn't a fake strawberry or a fake anything, really. But then once we start messing with food, engineering food, refining it, that changes. Pleasure used to match up with food, but then we changed it. So this is how you said food became unreliable. Talk about this part.
Food isn't just food. We metabolize protein differently than we metabolize fat, and differently we metabolize carbs. That's why we smell food. That's why we taste it. Even before food enters the mouth, there's the cephalic phase, which is a squirt of insulin. Your brain is saying, food's on the way, better get ready. So what we think of as taste, we've all kind of regarded as this frivolous, dangerous sensation out of touch with the important business of nutrition, is absolutely essential to it. When we taste food, your brain is getting an early reading on this is what's coming in. But here's what's very important. That's not where the measurement ends. More measurement happens after you consume food, after you metabolize it. The brain said, is this what did I get? Was it any good? This is how we learn about food. It's called post-ingestive learning. That's why when Michelle Kabanek drank the sugar water, it changed his appetite, because the brain analyzes what it got. Mm-hmm. And for all of our existence as a species, up until recently, the taste of food was reliable. So if you think of a sweet fruit, it may have been challenging to get that fruit. You may have to compete to get it. There might be a hungry cat of some kind, you know, waiting at the bottom of the tree to eat you. But once you got that sweet fruit, it was reliable, a reliable source of calories. The sweeter, the more calories it contained. Fat is similar. In fact, we don't even sense fat with a receptor. We sense it with our touch receptors in the mouth. Fat is a feeling. It's creamy. It's rich. It's mouth-filling. And our brains learn over time that sensation equals calories. Well, that was true for all of existence up until around a few decades ago. We started to invent additives that can create the sensation of fatty richness, but at fewer calories. That's why we have things like light salad dressings or light mayonnaises, low calorie this, low calorie that. If the brain is stupid and the appetite is dumb, just kind of this Stone Age ogre on a mission to stuff its face, these are all really good ideas. Let's fool that dummy with foods that taste like they have more calories than they actually have. But what if the brain's actually really smart and it measures what's coming in and it measures what it got? That means it's not so easy to fool the brain. And then you have to ask yourself, well, what does the brain do once it gets fooled? And that's where I think we see the difference. The nutrients haven't changed. Fat is still fat. Carbs are carbs. They haven't changed in eons. What has changed is the information the brain gets from the taste of food.
And since food is no longer reliable, the way we reacted to it, as you explain in the book, is the way any animal reacts to uncertainty, and that is by cranking up the motivation. And I guess this cranking up of motivation gets us to this intense craving.
That's right. And it seems abstract and strange, but when the brain is faced with uncertainty, it reacts. It doesn't sit there and brood and wallow in kind of indecision. It has this immediate reaction of amping up motivation. If the sensation of calories becomes uncertain, it leads to what psychologists call reward prediction error. It cranks up motivation. And that's what we see when we look at brain scans of people with obesity. They don't enjoy food too much. They want it too much.
Mark Schatzker, his book is The End of Craving, Recovering the Lost Wisdom of Eating Well. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the food writer Mark Schatzker. We're talking about his book, The End of Craving. One of the things you write in the book is that we've used our knowledge about nutrition to, this is how you put it, dumb down our omnivorous nature. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, it's really interesting. If you think about what Michelle Kavanagh was saying, that our urges are in some way in line with our needs, then modern eating just seems bafflingly sort of suicidal. What's going on? But when we look at animals, we see all sorts of cases where this is correct. There's the goats of Olympia Park in Washington. For years and years, there was never goats that lived there. It would just get too much rain, and there's just not enough minerals in the water. But this changed. Around the 1920s, hunters brought goats to Olympia National Park because they thought this would be a great place to shoot them. And the goats learned that you can drink human urine, and that's how they got their minerals. They would steal sweaty shirts off a clothesline. And this seems stunningly intelligent. So you think, well, were humans ever like that? And in fact, we were. If we look back at the nutritional deficiency called scurvy, which is a deficiency of vitamin C, we all remember it from, history class. This was characterized by a swelling of the gums. And that's true. Their gums really did swell, and all sorts of awful, horrible things like old wounds would open up. But as the ship's chaplain, they would write a diary. They would say the first symptom was a craving for fruits and vegetables. This was hundreds of years before James Lind did the experiment, which showed that fruits and vegetables could cure scurvy. This was eons before we had any idea of what vitamins were. There was just this urge, the brain saying, "I know what I need." So we have this ability to derive what we need from food. Our urges direct us towards the foods that we need. Well, then you look at a policy like enrichment and fortification, where we start putting vitamins in things like energy drinks and soft drinks and processed carbs. Well, that's not how it was meant to work. And all of a sudden, we're feeding ourselves literally the way we feed pigs. And I think this disrupts the way the appetite is meant to work, that our urges no longer send us out to eat foods that we need. And it's just an unnatural relationship. It's not how we were meant to eat.
Yeah. So what you're saying for those of us who have embraced, let's say, a low-carb lifestyle, or those who are trying intermittent fasting, that if people can somehow find a way to get back, I don't know, to square one, you know, eating real food, not highly processed, not highly engineered or fortified food, if they can get back to that point and then just trust their bodies to regulate their weight, that they don't need to do any of that macro counting or body hacking or diet strategizing. Is that what you're saying?
Well, for one thing, none of that hacking or counting works. You know, we carry on like we're these expert nutritionists. The truth is the message keeps changing. We keep getting different instructions, and we're hilariously incapable of even following the instructions. But the important point on a grander level is that we did not evolve to become nutritionists and to think of food in terms of protein and amino acids and, you know, squirts of insulin and so forth. We evolved to eat. And the pleasure of eating food, the way it tastes, the way it makes us feel, is telling us something important. We've been trying to resist that and suppress that, and we need to embrace it. That is how Italians eat, and I think that is how we need to eat.
Yeah. Let's come back to Italy, because as you mentioned, there were two ways of dealing with the pellagra crisis. The Americans came up with an effort to pump vitamins into food, this enrichment fortification movement. But the other model, of course, is Italy's. They took that old path. And in the book, you actually go to Italy to figure out why they chose this path. So let's talk about what you found, if you can. And let's talk about one place in particular that seemed to hold at least part of the answer. It's a village called Limone. Tell us about Limone.
So Limone is this little village up in the mountains that has a bean festival. They grow beans there. It's a member of the Borlotti bean family. They have four different varieties, and they think they are the best beans anywhere. There's several other villages in Italy that also feel they have the best bean. And they take it very seriously. And I went there, and I found once again I was embroiled in arguments about food. I met one guy, said, how should you cook the beans? And he's such a purist. He had his favorite variety. He said, you should just dress it with a neutral vegetable oil. He didn't even want olive oil because that's like, you know, putting ketchup on it. That's how much of a purist he was. Then others say, step in and say, no, you should put an onion in when you boil it. Someone else said, you can put a clove of garlic. Should you put in rosemary? That's controversial. Then the whole question of what's the best variety came up, and then more argument ensues. And I thought to myself, everywhere I go, all humans can do is argue about food. But there was an important difference, and this was kind of like a lightning bolt of insight. I realized that in North America, when we argue about food, it's about nutrients. It has been for decades. It was fat, carbs, keto, this, that. You go to Italy, they're not talking about any of that. They're saying, is this the best recipe? What, your grandmother doesn't know what she's talking about. This is a better recipe. The villages spar over who does it right. But everywhere for them isn't this opportunity to say, what am I putting in my body? It's this opportunity to extract the maximum amount of pleasure from the food that they are eating. It seems dumb. It seems that's a surefire way to not eat well, but it unquestionably is a better way of eating.
Mm. So the answer is coming back to experiencing food, which gets us back to Goethe, because you mentioned that Goethe's writing was the only place, for example, where you found, at least in terms of a scientist or a researcher, it was the only place where you found the word experience among scientists talking about food. And what is it that he saw in the world that we don't? Because you talk about these different qualities in life that he saw that maybe are some guidance for us in terms of the way we should be thinking about the experience of food.
You know, it was so interesting, my discovery of him. He's not just a poet, he's also a philosopher of science. The reason I came upon him was because he had this run-in with pellagra as he was escaping to Italy. But what's so amazing is he actually diagnosed the cause. In this offhand remark, he said it's obviously because they're eating a diet too rich in corn. He didn't know about niacin, but he came up with the same thing that Goldberger came up with decades and decades and decades later, which is to say these people aren't eating a diverse enough diet, too much corn. Well, then I kind of started to follow this breadcrumb trail, and I realized that this guy isn't just a poet. He was a philosopher, and he was someone who it's like he was born to experience all aspects of life. He gave up this very pampered, courtly life to go and live anonymously under a pseudonym in Italy. And his writings on science are fascinating. He invented the study of morphology, which is the study of living form. And he had a great dispute with the scientists of his era because he felt that they didn't understand the difference between living things and machines. And I recall reading this and thinking, like, what is this guy talking about? But it unfolded, and it was so interesting. He pointed out that the scientists of his day they just want to classify everything. You know, this bird is related to this bird, but it has a longer claw or a curved beak. It was all about classifying. And they saw animals as essentially being biological machines. So kind of like a wind-up toy, but instead of having springs, we have things like a heart that beats and tendons and muscles. So we were just sort of organic mechanisms. And he said that's wrong on two levels. The first is that living things contain wholeness. And I mean, we hear that word a lot, but he uses it in a way that kind of is mind blowing. He says the part contains the whole, that when you look at a plant, you see the form of the leaf in all stages of the plant. You see it in the seed, you see it in the flower. The whole is always contained and visible in the part. If you look at a machine, that never happens. If you think of a car, you can study the steering wheel. You can dip it in acid. You can put it under an electron microscope. It will never tell you anything about the upholstery. It won't tell you anything about the engine. The design is external to it. The design exists somewhere else as a blueprint. In living things, the design is visible. He influenced Darwin's understanding of evolution when he pointed out that all animals, skeletons, he saw them as designs, that a human skeleton was an awful lot like a whale skeleton. There was many things that were similar. He also said that change is fundamental to living things, that a machine, it isn't born, it doesn't develop, it doesn't die. It just sort of is brought into existence and then is subject to the law of entropy and just eventually stops working one day. And that living things change according to what they are given, that a plant will grow differently on the north side of a mountain than it will on the south side. Now, this all sounds sort of interesting and abstract. What does it have to do with anything? I think he would look at the way we think about food and eating and nutrition as though we are machines. We talk about calories as though that's energy, but we know that's not true because you also need vitamins. And the act of eating is the act of obtaining wholeness from your environment. It was just a kind of a breathtaking insight into our nature. And the fact that this is a guy who went to Italy, and he didn't go just to cram his face full of food. He wanted to experience food. Yeah. He didn't want to feed himself. He wanted to eat.
You say in the book, the joy that nature bestows on this experience of eating, that's the thing that should guide us forward. But how do we relearn that? Because it's not a program, you say. Eating is propelled by this force. You say it's a performance of life itself. So how do we relearn that?
I think it's getting in touch with the feelings of eating. And that's why I found that session with Anya Hilbert so interesting, because it taught me a lot about the foods that perhaps we shouldn't eat, foods that, you know, get you in this sort of reinforcement, kind of like your hand goes back in the bag, you keep stuffing your face, versus foods that actually deliver real pleasure. So I think it's not going to happen overnight. It certainly takes time and takes all sorts of exposure to the wrong food for our brains to get to the wrong place. But I think there's something, this idea that if you expose yourself to real food and indulge in the enjoyment of it, you can bring your brain back to the right place.
Where do you think, finally, where do you think we're headed when you look at the landscape now? Because it seems like, and I won't oversimplify this, but it seems like the choice is a fine piece of chocolate, you know, a manageable portion of delicious, maybe slightly bitter dark chocolate, or chips, or fake meat, which you write about as well. What's the direction you see us going in?
I think we're going in many directions. I see certain things that I think are promising, you know, things like farmers markets, things like an interest in heirloom fruit. I know that some companies are taking seriously the idea of flavor and breeding flavor into things that we eat. I love grass-fed beef. I think this is, you know, beef, it's meant to be raised and it has a much better flavor when, you know, when it's raised properly and so forth. But I think also we look at things like all these non-dairy milks, or we look at plant-based meat. And this is the new road. This is us saying, no, you know, food is dumb. Nature's a moron. I can do it better. And that's never worked. And I don't think it will work. I don't think foods whose DNA is built on a deception are going to work. You know, we're simultaneously rushing in two directions. One I think is good and one I think is wrong.
Mark Schatzker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Schatzker, he's a writer in residence at the Modern Diet and Physiology Research Center at Yale University. His book is The End of Craving: Recovering the Lost Wisdom of Eating Well. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Stu Nolan. The program produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.